This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. Kobe Bryant, one of the greatest basketball players of all time, died in a helicopter crash on Sunday.
Bryant's daughter Gianna was also killed along with seven other people.
They were worldwide tributes are pouring in for Kobe Bryant.
And the 24-second shot clock is going to wear out, Lamar, as they tribute Kobe Bryant's 24.
Kobe Bryant was 41 years old. And really, where else could we start this week's show? I'm joined by Lindsay Gibbs, writer of the Power Plays newsletter, and by Michael Lee of The Athletic. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me back, although I wish it wasn't under these terms.
Absolutely. So, Michael, NBA teams have been taking intentional 8 and 24-second violations in honor of Kobe, who wore both numbers during his career. Some players have decided to change their jersey numbers. This is all to say that Kobe had a pretty big influence on this league, right?
Absolutely. I mean, Kobe, he had a lot of gumption. You know, he was this guy who thought that he was good enough to enter the NBA right out of high school, who thought that after winning three championships with Shaquille O'Neal that the Lakers should dump Shaq and keep him to build around. He was a guy that saw any shot on the floor and said, you know, I can make it. And players truly admired and respected him for all of that gumption, what a lot of people call that Mamba mentality. He wanted to win 8 championships and he fell short, only had five. And he wanted to be considered better than Michael Jordan. And I think later in his career, he realized that there was an emptiness to that pursuit, that individual accolades and honors can only be so fulfilling. And toward the end, he recognized that he needed to pay it forward with the next generation. And so if Paul George broke his leg, he would reach out and offer him a helping hand. Isaiah Thomas, after his sister passed, he reached out to him without knowing him and decided that the best way to help him through that pain was to just go over film with him. And those type of connections made Kobe a much more relatable figure than, say, a Michael Jordan, who always seemed to be above it all, who always seemed to be the guy that you wanted to be like, but you actually couldn't be. Kobe was a guy that you could be like, but he'd be willing to put his arm around you and offer support. And that's why players around the league seem to take his death so hard. He was their hero, but he also was a big brother type mentor.
Yeah, I completely agree. I've been talking with a lot of women's basketball players, and what's interesting is they're all saying the same thing. When Breanna Stewart tore her Achilles, she said Kobe was one of the first people to reach out to her. And that mentality he had, I mean, the Mamba mentality, it really did have an impact. I was talking to Diana Taurasi, the most intense person. She said to her, it was Kobe that made being obsessive that cool.
It just says a lot about Kobe and his maturity toward the latter part of his career, where he realized that he could definitely do great things as an individual, but he could do greater things as being a light and an inspiration.
All right, Lindsay, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Yeah. Obviously, another aspect of Kobe's legacy is the sexual assault trial in 2003, when he was pretty credibly accused of rape. The alleged victim ended up pulling out of the trial a few days before because the abuse she was receiving was just so much. I mean, the legal system messed up, made her name available. Her face was on tabloids, and then they did reach an out-of-court settlement in the civil suit, and Kobe released a statement in which he said that he acknowledged, after listening to her, that he now understood that while he thought their encounter was consensual, that she did not. So this all happened 2003 and 2004, but the legacy really lived on. Kobe really didn't reckon with this publicly. He was still enforcing the non-disclosure agreement that they had reached, at least up until a couple of years ago. And he also would not get into details when asked about it in the media. And so I wrote about this in 2016 when he retired. And because of that, my email inbox and my direct messages have just been flooded with survivors reaching out to me, pretty much asking how they should feel right now. you know, well, he was also a big advocate of women's basketball. So which one wins out? And I wish it were simple, but the answer is they both exist. And it's been so hard because there's been a lot of backlash to anybody in the media or online who has brought up the rape case. People saying now is not the time, you know, he's not the worst moment of his life. And what I've tried to hold and remind people is that survivors are listening too. Survivors are a part of this conversation too.
Michael?
I think that's one of the reasons why people should be sensitive during this time, because there are people who have pain that needs to be respected and, you know, not pushed away at this time. People are so obsessed with hero worship in this country that we don't really want to look at someone's faults. Humans are very complex. You can be good and be bad. You know, you can do evil and be great. He definitely had a very dark moment, and I think he was haunted by that. It was something that I think he never necessarily felt like he did anything wrong, right? Mm. And I think in his mind, he sort of convinced himself that he didn't. But I think he also knew he wasn't going to be accepted completely because of what happened. And I think in a lot of ways, he tried to compensate or maybe overcompensate for what he did that day. And it changed his path in some ways.
It's been really interesting watching all the, you know, girl dad hashtags. And Kobe was such a great family man, and he was such a champion for women and women's sports and women in the boardroom. And all those things seem to be true. Kent Babb of The Washington Post described it this week as Kobe trying to flood the sexual assault charge off of his resume. Like, maybe if he did enough good, especially enough good for women, maybe that night in Colorado wouldn't be the thing that he was remembered for. You know, I suppose the cynic in me could say that it was all a PR stunt, but I don't believe that to be true. And I'm not really sure it matters. Like, does it matter why you're doing good things? If you're doing good things, that helps you become a better person.
I always had a hard time, honestly, with what sometimes seemed like over-the-top and performative support of women's sports and women's basketball in particular. It always felt a little, maybe a little phony to me. And I didn't like the way the media would at times cover his support of women's sports more than they would cover women's sports itself, you know? I grapple with a lot of these problems. Yeah. But I talked with so many of the players, and Sue Bird, and like I mentioned, Diana Taurasi, Renee Montgomery. They all talked about how much his support meant to them and how genuine it was. Diana Taurasi told me, Kobe Bryant doesn't fake anything, you know, like he is genuine. Sue Bird told me it means something when Kobe Bryant sees you as an equal, and he saw women's basketball as an equal. I've been realizing how much that was true and not phony. And I think maybe what I hope is that that part of his legacy isn't forgotten, that people will step up and carry on that part of his legacy and of Gigi's legacy, the legacy they never really fully got to live out.
May I add one part?
Absolutely.
I want to give some credit to his daughter, Gianna, Gigi, because I remember being at the All-Star game in 2016, Kobe's last All-Star game, and it was basically a celebration of Kobe. The entire weekend was all about him. And Kobe, in his last press conference there, Gigi was there with him. And he was squeezing her so tight. And he was just basically talking about how she's going to be the one to carry the legacy, the Bryant name, you know, in basketball. And, like, it was just beautiful to see their connection and their bond. And I think that Kobe was ready to step away from the game and just be done with basketball. But this season in particular, he started showing up to more games. And I thought it was a beautiful thing that his daughter brought him back in. And he wanted to make sure that she had the role models in place. That's part of his legacy as well.
Gino Auriemma told a wonderful story about how he's the head coach of the UConn women's team, and how when Kobe and Gigi would come, that Gigi would be so starstruck at the UConn women's players. And then, of course, all the players were starstruck at Kobe. And he thought, your dad is Kobe Bryant. You get to be around all these celebrities. And here you are, completely, like, shy and starstruck by these women's college basketball players.
All right. So I'll admit I had a really hard time choosing my favorite Kobe Bryant story to share this week. There are just so many wonderful ones. But here's the story I landed on. Did you know that Kobe Bryant saved the big Idaho potato truck?
No, I did not.
Okay, so in 2012, the Big Idaho Potato Truck was dreamed up as a way to celebrate the 75th anniversary of the Idaho Potato Commission. And it is literally a giant red tractor trailer pulling an enormous fiberglass potato. And in 2016, there was talk of taking the truck off the road. But meanwhile, Heather Cox was working as a courtside reporter for ESPN and other outlets, and she also appeared in a commercial about the Big Idaho Potato Truck. And in an interview with Kobe in 2016, Kobe teased Heather Cox about that commercial. And just the fact that Kobe Bryant had noticed the commercial and, like, mentioned it was enough to convince the commissioners that the truck should not be taken off the road. I mean, it really kind of shows you his power.
Wow.
But Heather Cox has a really different takeaway from this story, and she says it's an example of how Kobe Bryant could make anyone or anything feel important. And that's why I wanted to share this story.
That's pretty cool.
My guests for this week's All Kobe edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Lindsay Gibbs, writer of Power Plays, an email newsletter about sexism in sports, and The Athletic's Michael Lee. Thank you, Lindsay. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have just enough time for one more story about Kobe Bryant. You might remember that back in 2018, Kobe was nominated for an Academy Award.
And the Oscar goes to... Don't say La La Land, don't say La La Land. Dear Basketball, Glenn Key and Kobe!
Dear Basketball was an animated short written and narrated by Kobe Bryant. The words came from the poem he wrote to announce his retirement in 2015. That December, Bill Littlefield called Lower Merion High School outside of Philadelphia to talk to an expert about that poem.
Gene Mastriano, what do you think? B, B minus?
I would walk away from grading this kind of a piece. I would definitely put it back in the lap of the writer and just ask about investment, ask about purpose. What were you going after? And I think he did the job.
Now, Mrs. Mastriano, we should explain why your opinion counts. You were Kobe Bryant's 10th grade English teacher, and then you had him again in 12th grade, right?
Oh, you've done some research.
Yeah,
speaking arts, yes.
Yeah. Were you surprised when Kobe Bryant referred to you as his muse in a pregame press conference last week?
Yeah, it was the first time I'd ever been indirectly called a demigoddess, right? A muse, one of the nine sister goddesses of inspiration, right? Yeah, he didn't call me a muse when he was in high school, you know, but we had a good relationship. He was remarkably disciplined in high school. He was getting pulled out to play with this team or that team, and he'd be gone for days, and he'd come back with the assignments in hand. That was super. I respected him a lot for that.
There has been some debate, of course, about whether Kobe Bryant really wrote Dear Basketball. I am in the camp that says it's pure Kobe. What do you think?
I would second that. I don't know either. It took me completely by surprise. There's too strong a sense of through line, you know?
Through line.
Like just a sense of, I have a purpose. Get out of my way. I'm taking this down court, and I'm getting it done, you know?
Well, I think it's fantastic that you and Kobe Bryant have maintained this relationship as his basketball career has played out, and I'm curious about whether you have a favorite Kobe story.
This could be lengthy, Bill. I don't know if...
Not a problem, really.
Okay. The Lakers were in NBA Finals. My husband and I were watching, and it was, I don't know, game three, game four. I think it was the Celtics. I'm not sure. But it was an amazingly intense game. They all the people on that court played full out. The Lakers lost by, like, I don't know, 2 points. It was back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And I turned to my husband. I just said, oh, you know what's a shame? It's so beautiful. This was such a beautiful battle, and it's all about the struggle. It doesn't matter. And I just ranted about how beautiful it was and what a shame it was that one half of the men on that court were going to go home absolutely devastated. And I said, I don't know how the Lakers get it together to go in for the next game. They just left everything there. And my husband just listened to me, and he just said, well, you should tell him that. I said, well, Kobe has plenty of people around him to tell him that. He said, well, he doesn't have you. And I was like, no, I'm not gonna bother him. So we go to bed. So 3 a.m., I come down the stairs, punch in this phone number, which was always goes to a voicemail. I never get any sort of response, but just punch this number, and I get this machine, and I just went off about the struggle and the beauty of it and how wonderful it all was, and I just went on and on and on. And at the end of it, I went, by the way, this is Mrs. Mastriano. And I didn't hear a thing. And then they went on. The Lakers went on, and they went on to beat the team that they were playing through, the Celtics. And we were dedicating the new gymnasium. And he was coming in, and there's always a lot of press when he's arriving in town. And I got an email at school saying, how does Downer was Kobe's coach, how does Downer feel about you talking to him, giving him advice during the finals? And I wrote back, what? I didn't talk to him. He sent me a link to an ESPN article, and there it was in print. Yeah, I talked a lot with her through the finals. It's like, what? We were gathering in this little anteroom, and it was just, we were sitting quietly in the room. And I just brought this article up, and he said, yeah, well, you remember when you called me during the finals? And I said, yes, but the article says, we talked. Conversation implies that one person speaks and the other person responds. And he laughed, and he said, well, I'll tell you. I saved that message, and I played it over and over and over again as I was getting ready for the rest of the games.
Bill Littlefield spoke with Kobe Bryant's 10th grade English teacher, Jean Mastriano, back in December of 2015. In an interview published in USA Today just last week, Kobe credited Mrs. Mastriano for his interest in the written word, saying, quote, she firmly believed that storytelling could change the world, and she opened my eyes to this passion I didn't know existed. Mrs. Mastriano told the New York Times this week, he left such a void behind, it's going to be tough. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Do eat this, don't eat that. If you feel like it's time to finally end your war with food, this is the podcast for you. Food, we need to talk. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Karen Given. For much of the 20th century, the sport of highlife was a big deal, not just in Basque Country, where it originated, but around the world. In the 1960s, highlife was marketed to Americans as the next big sensation in sports, as anyone who watched Mad Men might remember.
Imagine the perfect mixture of athletics, spectacle, and speed. Highlife.
Highlight is like handball, only you fling the ball and catch the ball with this basket thing.
It's more highlight players use that basket thing, it's called a cesta, to hurl a small, hard, goatskin-covered ball at speeds of almost 200 miles an hour, which is how highlight earned its title as
the world's fastest game.
Quite recently, in Mexico City, highlight helped one Basque expat find a home. Reporter Maya Croft has the story.
When he was growing up in a small fishing village in French Basque Country, my friend Mikel Larregui was obsessed with two things, Basque food and highlight, the Basque national sport. He still remembers the first match he ever saw.
No, yo creo que tenía 10 años.
I was 10. It was a great match with a famous forward named Kachin Uriarte. I remember I was with two friends and we were shouting the whole time, just being crazy kids. Highlight in Basque means happy party. High is party and a lie is happiness.
Come to think of it, there might not be two better words to describe Mikel himself. He's got an easy laugh and he always seems to be on his way to or from a party. He's always got like a bottle of wine under one arm and a pretty girl on the other. Like every Basque kid, Mikel wanted nothing more than to grow up to be a professional highlight player. Highlight used to be a real high society kind of thing, from Mexico City to Manila to Miami, where ads like these ran on TV. Celebrities and presidents like to be photographed at highlight games, but for a bunch of complicated reasons, the sport started shedding fans in the 1980s, right around when Mikel was growing up. And it never really recovered. Hialeah courts, which are called frontones, started shutting down, and even the one in Mexico City, which was the biggest one on the planet, closed its doors in the 90s. But in Basque Country, Hialeah is everything. As a teenager, Mikel was good, but not that good. He didn't quite have the discipline to go pro. He wanted to party and travel and see the world outside his village. So at 18, he went to culinary school in San Sebastian, and he spent his 20s cooking and traveling his way around Basque Country. 5 years ago, just before he turned 30, he made his biggest move yet, to Mexico City.
Bueno, yo siempre quise viajar, vivir en una ciudad grande.
I always wanted to live in a big city, someplace with a lot of energy, a lot of culture. And Mexico City is one of the biggest cities in the world.
But it wasn't easy leaving Basque Country behind.
My village is a very relaxed place. There are only 4 bars in town, so everybody knows everybody. I miss home. I miss my family, my friends, nature, the local food. The quality of life I miss a lot.
At first, Mikel's life in Mexico was kind of aimless. He thought he might open a Basque restaurant, but he didn't know anybody. He had no idea where to start. One day, he saw an older man on the metro who would change his life in Mexico completely. The man was holding 2 cestas, those basket things. They're about 3 feet long, and traditionally they're woven by hand using reeds from the Pyrenees Mountains.
I thought it was interesting to see a man that age, he was 82, with 2 cestas in his hands. He was wearing white pants, and that caught my attention, because that's usually what Hialeah players wear in official matches. I knew they played Hialeah in Mexico, but I'd never met anyone who actually played.
Mikel went up to the man, who introduced himself as Luis, and he asked about the cestas.
He told me he was on his way to play, and he invited me to go with him. I don't remember what I was doing, but I guess I canceled my plans. We played 10 or 15 minutes, and it was great. I hadn't played in 10 years. He invited me to play again on Thursday, and we played against another older guy, around 55 or 60, named Samuel Inclán, who'd been one of the best Hialeah players in Mexican history. One of the best in the world. He'd been retired for years, but Luis and I played against him, and we won. We won.
But after that day with Luis, just like the world had in the 90s, Mikel forgot about Hialeah. Until about 6 months later, when a friend from back home came to visit. Mikel suggested they go to the place the old man from the metro had taken him. He figured it would be empty. I mean, who even plays anymore, right? Except a couple of lost Basques and some retirees. But when they got there...
I was shocked. It was a Sunday, and there were tons of people there. Everybody wearing the white pants. I couldn't believe there were so many people. Old guys, young kids, everybody playing together. It was amazing. A guy about my age came up to me and said, "You should go in for a minute or two. Let's see what you've got." I played for 2 minutes, and he said, "Hey, you can really play. You should come back next Sunday to play for real." So I went back the next Sunday, and they lent me all the gear. The white pants, the cesta. I don't remember if I won or lost, only that I was super excited to be playing again. That night, I went home and wrote to my mom and asked her to send me my old stuff. The white pants, my helmet. I ordered myself a new custom-made cesta here in Mexico, and I started to play. I got hooked. I started to play every Sunday, every Sunday. I was constantly listening to or watching Hialeah matches on YouTube. Bit by bit, I was able to get my arm back, my wrist flicks, my strength. Sunday after Sunday, I never missed a week. I was getting better and better, playing against some of the best players in Mexico.
One day, Mikel got a chance to play against a pro named Christoph Sanchez.
Él fue profesional entonces en Cancún, Miami.
Christoph had played professionally in Miami, in Acapulco, in Cancun. He's not really one to give compliments, but he told me I played really well.
Christoph told Mikel that professional Hialeah was coming back to Mexico City for the first time in more than 20 years. The city's legendary frontón was set to reopen, and they were going to need players. If he trained really hard, Christoph said, Mikel had a shot at making the team.
No, pues le dije de verdad.
I was like, for real? Are you serious? You really think I could play? I thought he was making fun of me. Couldn't believe it. I'd been out of the game for 10 years. I was already 30 years old. But from the moment he said that, I started to believe it. There are times when you see a dream is so close you can almost taste it, and you start to think it couldn't be possible. I was nervous.
That summer, Mikel went back home to visit. He couldn't wait to tell his childhood friends that that thing they all dreamed about, playing Hi-Li professionally, well, he was going to get a chance to make that dream come true. But the news didn't go over quite like he hoped.
Mis amigos...
All my friends teased me. They thought I was just talking crap or dreaming because they couldn't believe that I was about to be a professional Hi-Li player in Mexico.
But when Mikel got back to Mexico, Christoph took one look at him and shook his head.
The problem was, when I went back home, I ate. A lot. I ate a bunch of cheese, I gained weight. When I got back a few months later, Christoph scolded me. He told me I hadn't listened to him, I was being stupid, that I couldn't play if I was overweight. I got deflated and sad, but determined to get serious for real this time.
Mikel buckled down and trained and trained and trained, and in November 2016, he got word that he'd made it. He would be one of 32 professional Hi-Li players on the Mexico City team. And like all pros, he even got a nickname. Matasagueros, or Defender Killer. Sounds like a compliment, but it's really not. It's a joke, teasing Mikel for making his teammate, his defender, work too hard. When Mikel made the team, he and his teammates went out for beers to celebrate, and he called his friends back home to say, basically, I told you so. By the time the season started in the spring, he was pumped.
Bueno, la...
Opening night was spectacular. I was like a kid. I was super excited to be there with those players, playing for so many people. My cousin flew in just to be there. There was a red carpet and they invited all these famous people. It was a really memorable night. They introduced me as the Mexican Basque and the crowd went wild. It was an amazing moment.
Mikel's Hi-Li career was short-lived. The reopening of the Mexico City Frontón didn't attract quite as much attention as promoters hoped, so the next season was shorter and the team smaller. Mikel didn't make the cut. But being the Mexican Basque, even just for one season, had its perks.
The people who play Hi-Li in Mexico belong to the highest social class. They're people with money. So it was helping me make contacts, especially among the Basque expats.
Contacts are crucial in Mexico, where doors open for people who know someone who knows someone. Last summer, I went with Mikel to a Hi-Li match, and as we walked through the lobby to our seats, we couldn't go 5 feet without some important-looking person coming up to him, shaking his hand, saying hello. Making these connections has helped Mikel feel at home in this city of 25 million people. Half a world away from his little Basque fishing village.
It's not easy to live day to day with our culture. Our language is on the brink of being lost. And much of our cultural, artistic tradition, the dances, Hi-Li, it's all dying out. So we're really trying to reclaim all of that. And it's really beautiful to see that in Mexico, they still play our sport. That's amazing. It's a really moving and powerful experience for me.
This spring, Mikel hopes to make his other dream come true, finally opening that Basque restaurant. He tells me he still misses Basque country, but it's clear that, for now anyway, he's found a home in Mexico City, thanks, in part, to Hi-Li.
That story came from reporter Maya Croth. And some late-breaking news. Just this week, Mikel got called up to play when Mexico City Hi-Li season starts up again in May. It's almost time for Charlie Pierce to say,
the Super Bowl is good.
But as we all know, not everything about the Super Bowl is good. Take this. For the 47th time, the head coaches of both Super Bowl teams are white. The majority of this year's players are not. The NFL's problem with racial disparity in the head coaching ranks has been well documented, and efforts to fix the issue haven't been successful. Derek Z. Jackson, contributor to The Undefeated, sees a connection between this problem and another he's been watching at a lower level of football. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Karen. How are you doing?
Good. So how long have you been tracking the graduation rates of college athletes?
It's my 24th year.
Wow.
I started it at the Boston Globe and then moved it to The Undefeated.
I don't want to get too deep on the details. We'll have a link to those on our website. But on average, college football bowl teams graduate more of their white players than they do their African-American players. How disparate are those numbers?
Well, the four teams that played for the national championship, the average disparity, racial disparity, was 27 points,
wow,
percentage points. A lot of teams are only graduating about half or a little more than half of their black players, and yet many, many teams of the bowl teams this year graduated 100% of their white players. The pressure that many reformers have brought to the sport indeed have raised the graduation rates of all the players. The nagging issue, more than a nagging issue, is that the NCAA seems pretty, based on lack of action, it's pretty clear that they're willing to sit with the disparities.
You wrote in your article for The Undefeated, quote, "Those disparities alone maintain the halo of white intellectual superiority among athletes, a centrifugal force in the conveyor belt of white coaches running majority black teams." But graduation rates aren't the only numbers you've been looking at. At some schools in your survey, every other African-American male student is a scholarship athlete. How does that play into this issue?
Wow. It's something that has become a pretty central part of my looking at these numbers now. We already know that African-American men are stereotyped as being athletes no matter what walk of life we're in.
So you cite a study that mentions this, and it mentions particularly an African-American student in the Big Ten who often gets mistaken for an athlete. Tell me about him.
Yeah, it was from a really good study on stereotypes on college campuses. And the kid said, "I'm 5'5", I weigh 135 pounds. You'll be surprised at how many whites walk up to me and congratulate me on a good game on the Monday after a football win."
I can't even imagine what position he could possibly play on a football team.
Yeah. You know, the serious part of this, though, there's multiple ways this is serious.
Let's talk about that, because there are probably a certain number of people who will listen to this idea and say, come on, what's the big deal? I mean, athletes have a great life. So what is wrong with it? Why is it damaging?
Oh, I think it's very damaging because for those black men, which is the vast majority, who want to go on into other professions, it's just not going to be assumed that they belong with the same in the same zone as a white peer. A 2014 study from Cal Poly Pomona said, quote, "The perception of athleticism is rooted in notions of black men as being hypermasculine. The image of the strong and aggressive athlete has been associated with low-income and working-class black men. To this day, we have studies that show that, you name the profession, African-Americans with the same resume are rejected." That means the sports stereotypes, to me, play a big piece in that, that all you can be is an athlete. And so, to me, it's patronizing to say, well, athletes are great. They make millions of dollars. But we know what percentage of human beings make millions of dollars as athletes.
So connect the dots for me. How does what's happening on college campuses directly affect the number of African-American coaches we see in the NFL?
I think it works like this. One, the graduation rates are disparate, which by definition means the universities expect excellence. In fact, perfection from their white athletes to play and graduate. They don't expect that from black men. That percolates the rest of the student body, like white students who will go on to run businesses and whatever, they will have that stereotype in their heads for the rest of their lives. So within just coaching alone, if you have that aura of intellectual inferiority already established, and then you're one of those white athletes who goes on into the coaching ranks, how likely is it that you're going to hire black coaches and bring them on if when you were playing with them, it was assumed they're not all of them going to graduate? So I think it's hugely psychological. There's nothing written in stone.
Right.
And that is the pernicious part of racism in sports today that leads to the fact that the NFL is now down to a hideous number of black coaches, and why baseball struggles and even the NBA is not equal in coaching ranks as they are in players.
So if this is a systemic problem affecting African American men in education, it seems like the Rooney Rule, which only says that NFL teams are required to interview a minority candidate for every head coach and GM position, that seems destined to fail. So what can we do?
Yeah, it's the Rooney Rule not only doesn't work, teams are making a mockery out of it. I mean, it's very clear they're hiring young white coaches who no one's ever heard of.
Right.
And they have to give black coaches that same kind of opportunity.
Derek Jackson is a contributor to The Undefeated. We'll have a link to his article, Big Time Colleges Care More About Money and Winning Than Black Athletes Getting Degrees, at onlyagame.org. Thanks, Derek.
Thank you.
It's almost time for the 26th edition of Super Bowl Haiku.
Unlike impeachment, football is bipartisan.
Grateful for reprieve.
That's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
Why is it so hard to make new habits? Are pets really that great for us? Why can't I remember where I put my keys? Would you rather be given an award or a bonus? Answers to these questions and more every week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
I'm Karen Given. Next week, for Oscars weekend, Only a Game goes to Hollywood with three unexpected tales of sports and the film industry. But now, Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
We opened the show with a conversation about Kobe Bryant's legacy, but I can't talk to you without also asking for your thoughts on that complicated question. How should we remember him?
I think it's entirely up to the individual. You have to work out in your own moral and ethical structure where you're going to place the awful crime he was accused of in the context of the rest of his life. And certainly, you know, nobody is questioning that his death is a tragedy, because not only he died, but so did his daughter and so did several other people. But in terms of what happened in Colorado in 2003, you have to factor that in somehow. That has to be part of his legacy. And not just the beginning of some sort of redemption tale either.
Have you been particularly moved by any of the tributes to Kobe this week?
Well, I mean, I think you can't help but be moved by how moved other people are. Mm. I mean, if you're in any way empathetic. He was after my time following the NBA very closely, so I never had any real contact with him. I recognize him as a very large figure in the history of professional basketball, but I have no personal feelings one way or the other in terms of who he was.
All right. It's time. Go ahead. Say it.
As you know, and as I've said on the show for several years now, the Super Bowl is good.
Funny you should say that, because Richard Wainerman, a listener in Washington, D.C., emailed us back on January 14th to say that he loves the show. He's been listening for at least 10 years, but he doesn't understand, given how, quote, detrimentally self-serving the NFL and its ownership can be, why you keep insisting that the Super Bowl is good. Can you explain?
Because it used to make Bill Littlefield laugh, and now it makes you laugh. And anything that makes Bill and Karen laugh, I tend to keep to hang on to.
Fair enough. All right.
And our listeners should just lighten up a little bit. That's all. And actually, this actually may be a very good Super Bowl.
Yeah.
These two teams seem very evenly matched. I think you could get a really good game out of this.
So you're rooting for the Chiefs like me?
You know, it's hard. It's very strange. I don't have any particular animus toward either team. It's fun to watch the Chiefs because of the way, you know, they play and because of Patrick Mahomes. But, you know, I like the 49ers uniforms, too. So, you know, I'm rooting for a good game. What can I tell you?
Good news, Charlie. MLB umpires will now wear microphones so that they can explain why reviewed calls were upheld or overturned. Gee, that's going to make for some riveting television.
Where are the microphones going to be?
I guess they're going to wear them.
Well, yeah, but where is my thing? If they wear them on their chest, then the standard manager, you know, move of bumping chests with the umpire is going to cause, like, explosions in the sound truck. I don't think they've thought this through very well.
No, probably not. In the latest Knicks news, this happened on Wednesday night. They're yelling, sell the team. Owner James Dolan was in the stands. He was not happy. He tried to get stadium security involved, reportedly singling out a teenager who happened to be sitting nearby. I hate to say it, but one less voice wasn't going to make much of a difference.
I was going to say, does he happen to have like 19,000 security guys on hand so they can throw everybody in the arena except him out?
He would if he could.
This is something that we've talked about on this show, I think, as long as there's been a show. There's one unsolvable problem for any sports fan, and that's a bad owner.
Yeah.
Because unless they go completely off the diving board the way, say, Marge Schott did, or they get tied up with the mob, there's nothing you can do about a bad owner.
And finally, Charlie, please, please, please tell me that it's time to...
Release the Kraken!
John Hoven, a sports blogger who calls himself the mayor, says sources have told him that the name of the NHL's expansion team in Seattle will be the Kraken. NHL Seattle did not confirm or deny the reports, but they did issue a statement filled with fish puns. So there's that.
Please, please let this be true.
Please.
And please let them invite Liam Neeson to opening night of the franchise so he can say it live. They can use the video, you know, for every home game from now until whenever the team folds. But for the love of God, have Liam Neeson show up to say it live. In the robes, too, by the way.
Please, yes. Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Karen.
Nine of the past 19 Super Bowls have featured the New England Patriots, but not this year. That was cause for lament in New England and celebration around the rest of the football world. In anticipation of Only a Game's annual Super Bowl haiku extravaganza, poets submitted dozens and dozens of haiku about a Super Bowl without Brady and Belichick. We could have done a whole segment on those alone. But we won't, because this year's Super Bowl features the Kansas City Chiefs and the San Francisco 49ers. They deserve the glory. And so, in that spirit, we present Super Bowl Haiku 26.
The snacks are ready. I'm in my favorite chair. Bring on your haiku.
The big day is here. The crowd in a frenzy for Punxsutawney Phil.
Chiefs fans remember their team in the Super Bowl.
If they're really old.
It's the Super Bowl. It has all come to this game.
Sadly, one will win.
Super Bowl Sunday. My team was out in week 8. Somehow, I still care.
Super Bowl 5-4. But the league is 100. Where are missing games?
I vote for Team Red.
The Chiefs or Niners? Which one?
Both. Both ways, I'll win.
How does this sport work? I listen to NPR. Inskeep, please explain.
9 years old and I played the Super Bowl daily in backyard. alone.
I watch funny ads, cute ads, sad ads, heartfelt ads. Why is there a ball?
I don't care who wins or who sings Big Halftime Show. It's only a game.
Bono, Britney, Prince. Only the best play four times. It's up with people.
Quarterback yelling, pigskin sailing for long yards. A fan drops his beer.
Pats fans watch Niners, think, how come we can't get a quarterback like that?
It looks neck and neck. Barbecue versus big tech. I'm rooting for ribs.
We love chicken wings. Every Super Bowl we eat millions of them.
We all know football is for the chicken wings, but football's the excuse.
Avocado, salt, lime juice, garlic, onion mash. Guacamole bowl. Avocado, salt, lime juice, garlic, onion, mash. Guacamole bowl. Yeah. What up?
Sea of red will part. One team will reach promised land.
The other, limbo.
Patrick and Jimmy, scrambling, slinging, fist pumping. Final score? A lot.
The Chiefs will not win. They will lose to the Niners. History repeats.
Andy's walrus stash hides pain of disappointment. Shave off after win?
Special thanks to everyone who submitted haiku this year, especially to Mrs. Suttle's sports literature class in Newark, Ohio, and for the second year in a row, the kids at Newington, New Hampshire Public Schools. Our Hut Hut haiku players were Amory Sievertson, Kelvin Brooks, Clint Kavanaugh, Walter Dixon, Hitesh Hathi, Kirsten Kalkhurst, Jack Lepiars, and Marquise Neal.
Unfortunately, Super Bowl haiku, all done. Let's change the station.
That's it for Only a Game, but please don't change the channel. I'm sure something great is coming up next. Only a Game is produced by Jonathan Chang, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.